You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hello, it's Friday, the 20th of February, 2006. I'm Rob Watson, and this is an INCJ podcast. And I'm joined today by Mateus, and I told you this would happen. Instantly, it goes out of my head. Amorim, there we go.
That's perfect. That's great.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. Who is joining us from São Paulo? And so you've told me it's lunchtime. Is that I can't believe that. But it looks bright sunshine through the window.
Yeah, for sure. Today it's a very hot day. We are towards the end of the summer. It's around I think 35 degrees outside today. What? And we're gathering up to have lunch very soon.
Well, here in the UK, it's supposed to be 10 degrees, but it feels a lot colder. So I imagine it feels 3 degrees. It feels like so. It's it's a chilly day here. So I have the electric heater on and a blanket and all sorts and tea, mugs of tea to warm me up. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about your work, and we were connected via a colleague. Dr. Victoria Knight, and she recommended we have a conversation. So do you want to introduce yourself? Who are you? What do you do? How did you get into what you do?
Yeah, perfect. I'm Mateus, just as you said, mentioned earlier. I come from a different part of Brazil, actually. I'm not from São Paulo. I'm from Fortaleza, which is the northeast of Brazil, where the beaches and all this kinds of beautiful places where most tourists go. And it's a very tropical state. And then I graduated in law over there in the Federal University of Ceará. I worked for some time as a lawyer, but it wasn't for me. I was just not cut for it. And all throughout my bachelor's degree, I was always interested in research and being a teacher and a professor and all those kinds of things. I took a lot of those, you know, stepping stones for it and took a liking to it. And then came an opportunity to study AI here, but a different area than my bachelor's degree, which is sociology. I always was fascinated by philosophy, sociology, all those kinds of things. It was always my interest. But changing areas is here in Brazil, it's very hard. It's not a very multidisciplinary, work environment in faculties and etc. It's very rigid sometimes to get from an area to another one. But it worked out. I got into sociology, did my master's, and I found a research area that I was able to meet up all my previous work in law. I mean, some of it, my understanding of law and such, and the new area that I was studying, which was AI, the future of work, the changes that AI systems bring to those social technical environments, you know. And then my research in doing my master's was in doing interviews with judges here in São Paulo, both state courts and federal courts. We have those two different ones. Sorry, Rob, some noises here. Hope you didn't catch that. But yeah, I did interviews with judges from both courts. The participants were a small group of 5 judges, but they were really, really keen on studying technology and implementing technology and etc. So that's the background. And to give you a further more detail on it, on why this research was so important, Hope you're not catching that. What are you?
Don't worry about it. It makes it sound live.
Yeah. So to give you a further background on why this research was so important is because the Brazilian judiciary system, and we're getting into, you know, the details now. The Brazilian judiciary system has been for, 10 years or so, been digitalizing itself more and more. It started with just, you know, digitalizing all the cases, files, and all these kinds of things. So by 2015, most courts already had online systems for judging cases, receiving pleas, and all these kinds of things. So everything was done online through those systems, and no more paper. Some courts still deal with paper. So that's one of the things we're going to talk a little bit more later, because there's a really heterogeneity between the conditions those courts have. Some are very rich, some are very poor. And then there's a stark difference in how they implement technology, how this technology impacts their work and organization as a whole. So just to backtrack a little bit, by that time, 2015, you had the digitalization of justice and those cases. And they were already starting to implement some other systems for digital services of justice. And then COVID hit, as we all know, and those public organizations just had to digitalize themselves much more quickly. And because of that, we see a rapid implementation of many, many, many technological tools and applications. And one of those things that were creeping up were AI systems. The justice system already used RPAs, robotic process automations, which are much more logical, mathematical, you know, no such thing as generative AI involved. It's like computing stuff and logical cadences. And they were already using that, but very minute, you know, very minute way. And then ChatGPT appeared and everything blew up. You know, everyone wanted to try it out. And what we saw was during those 5 years, my interviews really focused on this 5 year period between 2020, when the pandemic hits, and 2025, which we already had Gemini, Claude, ChatGPT, all those kinds of things already developed and in use. So judges were asked to speak a little bit about how everything changed in those 5 years, because it was a very transformative period. It was a very transitional period for the figure of the judge that was this kind of more, you know, focused on quantity of cases, had a much more, still has, but was a little bit less hands-on, you know. And then because of the amount of cases that are really still up to resolving and all these kinds of things, Brazilian judiciary system has a really huge backlog of cases, unresolved cases, and not enough human resources to deal with it. So that's a huge problem. And to answer your question briefly, we saw that AI was, just as any other area, thought of as a miracle tool to help with all those problems.
And has that been borne out? Is it a miracle tool? Because the same probably applies in the UK and Europe and in the United States, everywhere really, that people have looked at AI, but it's brought up another set of problems. So in terms of that's like people's expectations, because the AI has come in as, you know, it's been developed in the background and then it broke into the public consciousness about end of 24 and then through 25 in terms of being an applied tool that people could use. And initially, you know, kind of creating photographs or writing emails. But the as you say, the kind of systemic use of AI to interrogate information. I always prefer to think about, you know, the machine learning approach is it's really good for interpolation, but not extrapolation. So when people ask it to come to a decision, that's the wrong question. If you ask it to list and evaluate between different data sets, that's the kind of thing that it can do. So in your discussions with the judges then, what was their process mindset like? Did they have a sense of what their process was and how this would change or shape their enactment of that process?
Okay. So there's a very particular situation that is, my main focus on this research was checking on the implementation of AI decision-making tools. So the thing about the Brazilian judiciary system's AI tools is that almost every court develops its own tool internally. They found out that they just couldn't transfer tools from one court to the other because the contexts were so different. So everyone had to just make up their own. And that brings out a lot of other risks and problems that we might discuss later. But you were just completely spot on your perception, because when you implement those AI tools for decision making, you introduce some other variables, that is the human machine interaction as well. That's a very important part of it, because you see, most of these tools, they act on suggestion. Just as an example, one of the AI tools that the judges used, it read out the case files that the judge was willing to solve and decide upon. And it matched everything that was mentioned in it, the laws and whatnot, with already existing drafts of decisions that the judges already had in their files. It's because, I don't know if you know this, but since it's a very voluminous kind of work, you know, a routine, they simply make drafts of some decisions and some case, says please, etc., that are very frequent, and they just, you know, change some information and etc. to make it a little bit faster. So the system worked with that. It checked the case files and what was being mentioned in it, the arguments, etc., and it matched with the judge's drafts, and then made a suggestion. These drafts are the most appropriate for this decision. But the thing is, and this is why we need social sciences studying these contexts, is because when I spoke to the developer, the system, I asked him very, very blatantly, are the suggestions vertical suggestions? I mean, it appears for the judges it's a vertical list, or is it a horizontal list? And he just said, I mean, it's a vertical list. And for me, that's just, you know, that just points out how that might influence someone to just choose the first one, because it is almost as a ranking. You know, we as humans, we're very, 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 we tend towards just making the fastest decisions that we can. And when a system that was firstly developed internally within my court, secondly, using my data, I mean, presumably using the data from the court, and it's a system that I use daily, why will I not believe in this results? Do you see that? there's a whole other background of beliefs circling towards why that system might be dependable upon. And then the judges, you know, day to day using it, will not just ask themselves if it's the right or wrong suggestion. They might just go for it because they think that the system is reliable. And that's one of the biggest problems we see, is the lack of critical thinking when dealing with the AI suggestions. But that was one scenario. The other scenarios are much more worse, because what we are seeing now is that courts are not just using the systems that they developed themselves. They are buying licenses from ChatGPT, OpenAI, Microsoft Azure, all those kinds of things, adapting to their work. But in the middle of all of that, there's data sharing and all the sensitive information that the justice system deals with. And what the judges told me in the interviews is that they do receive some instructions, education on AI use, but it's just so basic. It's really basic. It does not touch upon ethical questions and how to deal with these complex tools, generative tools. So you have a really, really serious gap in skill for these judges. The judges that do study about AI and technology are very few, and they are the most afraid of how to use them, how to use the tools, but they still use it because, as I mentioned earlier, there's a huge backlog of stuff they had to do, they had to deal with it, and they are charged on productivity. There's a real, real, real pressure for productivity. And the changes that judges felt was much more pronounced in a way that they thought of themselves before, as just as I mentioned, as a worker that were just signing stuff out in very, very large quantities and not really paying attention to it. But now, because they have these systems, they have the impression that they are able to be a little bit more careful, and they feel that they have to be a little bit more careful. These judges, they are conscious of it. And they see themselves now in a position of a person that is much more towards the qualitative aspect of decision making. They are putting those tools to summarize the files for them, to find something in the documents that they need, and making analysis, very brief analysis of what they are dealing with, and then they make their judgments. The judges that I interviewed, they were very, very, very strict on how they dealt with the tools, because they said they checked everything. But, it was just five people. You can't expect that to, be everyone the same. Everyone deals with the same way. It's not that. Even them said that some of their colleagues did not really check anything. So you have that sense that the behavior is just, everyone on its own.
We have an example in the UK. There was a Scottish employment court gave a judgment which was instantly, it was quite a controversial topic. So it was picked on by social campaigners because it had to be corrected something like 17 times. A court can usually issue minor corrections, typos, that kind of thing. But this was, it made quotes from high court judgments, superior court judgments that didn't exist, and they'd not been checked by the judge, and it caused, so obviously it's going to appeal, but it caused a huge controversy because it was inventing names for participants and witnesses, and it hadn't been checked properly, and it was like, as a basic researcher, it's like kind of even an undergraduate academic researcher, you would be expecting somebody to do the work on the due diligence due due diligence on cross-referencing those things. So, I mean, but I suppose it's partly because the courts are under a lot of pressure that it feels easy and to just pass it on to the AI. I mean, is this a high pressure sales approach? Because I've done things where I visited Microsoft in their London HQ for a training session about using AI, and I mean I use the Microsoft AI, but I don't know why I pay for it, as it's integrated with into my office systems, whereas I use Gemini and ChatGPT mainly. But the, you know, it's the high pressure sales that goes with this, and the expectation that you should be using it is, you know, it's a big weight. And if you're a judge with a busy schedule and a high workload and pressures to move things along, I mean, both politically and commercially, did you ask any, glean anything from the judges that you spoke to or their colleagues about where that pressure comes from?
That's a perfect analysis you just made, because one of the things we observed, and one of my master's dissertation's hypothesis, is that this quick, really rapid, aggressive even, adoption of AI tools in the judiciary system comes from the expectations and the productivity demands and the pressure to, you know, just solve everything, the workload and et cetera. And it's guided from those discourses, you know, very basic discourses that we hear in very different places, all regarding AI. That is, it's more optimal, it's more objective, it's faster, it's better, it's more reliable, all of those kinds of things. It's just about speed, it's about being efficient, it's all of those things. And when, you know, push comes to shove, the judge has said, yes, I use those systems every day, but most of the time I have to redo many, many times. One of the judges was he was the keenest of them all, you know, in technology, really tech savvy kind of guy. And he said, I'm trying to develop a methodology to use it, the generative tools. And he said, I still haven't come up with a really reliable way to use it. I have to keep teaching it, keep resending it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a tool that promises productivity and it doesn't deliver. But it's a belief. It turns out to be a belief. You know, they think that they have to be modern. They think they have to implement technology to be on the edge of it. And there's another point in here, that is, the richer courts try to implement more technology, so they kind of get a little bit more power, status quo, and et cetera, maintain that kind of thing. And the poorer courts, they try to be at the same level, but they just can't.
Is an equalizer with this. I always say that the great advantage of AI is to be able to send back some officious managers equally officious emails in the same polite way. You know, so you can correspond by. I've got friends who aren't, say they work in a service industry, but they can use ChatGPT to engage with their managers, because managers are very good at writing long instructional emails, and they can use ChatGPT to send back a response which is professionally written and equally as procedural. So there's a kind of an equalization on that basis. But that's kind of an aside. But the main thought is really is about the justice of people, where it goes wrong. I mean, from a general experience, maybe not perhaps just from the conversations that you've had, or maybe are the judges aware that actually there is a fundamental principle here of justice being fairly enacted and objectively enacted, and to, you know, training judges as prompt engineers for AI systems isn't the same as understanding the law and natural justice. And how do they tussle with that? Is that something that you've asked, you know, you've considered or they've considered?
Yes, yes. Touching on that point, just as I mentioned it before, those five judges, they were really, really, I mean, a different kind of spectrum of the judges, because they were tax heavy. They were very, very well read, very highly educated judges. In the middle of their careers, you know, they were around 40 to 50 years old, already had around 15 to 20 years in the judiciary system in different scales and different positions. And they were very different in the sense that they made an effort to tell me all throughout the interview that they really cared about the due diligence of justice. So they made a really good point of, I read everything, I revise everything, I don't leave the AI results as is, I always check, etc. But as I said, it's five people. And in my PhD, I'm planning to, you know, broaden this research, maybe do an experiment of some sort. I didn't say in the beginning, but right now I'm undertaking my PhD, and it's the same research area, but just a little bit broader. And what I'm really interested in is, just as you said, there is a sales force kind of thing into it, because, and we see this in the discourse of high court judges, that they are asking for big tech companies to give out solutions for the judiciary system. One of the high court judges here in Brazil asked Amazon, all of those kinds of things, Microsoft, etc., to give them a solution that they could buy. And as it seems, it hasn't really worked out yet. But what we see is most courts are doing public-private partnerships to develop these tools. And this is a very risky area, because you have the data sharing and all these kinds of things. The pacts and the deals with these companies are still not so not really transparent enough, I think. They haven't really solved how to deal with these the data life and all those kinds of things. But to summarize, I mentioned briefly that they are leaving out the internal systems made by courts to using licenses. And that's a hybrid kind of scenario, because these are public systems, you know, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini. These are not professional systems. They are public systems, but used in professional context, adapted. And that it's a sort of, as you perceived, is a sort of influence on the use of these tools, because imagine yourself being a worker in these cases, and then all of a sudden your computer has a license for using ChatGPT, Gemini, and all those kinds of things, and you have add-ons that are made for consulting higher court decisions and all those kinds of things. So you think you're not going to use it. I mean, in a way, it's an implicit kind of incentive, because if the organization is giving out all of those licenses for everyone, it's kind of saying, I mean, it's over there. You can use it if you want to, but consider your workload, consider your routine, consider all of that. Are you not going to use it? I mean, it's a little bit being naive to think that it's not going to happen. So one of my interviewers said that she used it daily. She used it daily to consult high court decisions and etc. for anything that she was doing. So there's a really, really, really those are really used, and there's an incentive to using those tools, even though it's not explicit. But since they are buying those licenses, they feel like they have to use it. So in a way, when we connect that to the productivity, speed, efficiency discourse that it's around AI and the miraculous tool that will solve all their problems, it is a really, really, really incentive to use those tools. And one of the questions I made to the judges was, where do you think this will lead into the future? How do you see yourself in the next 5 years, for example? And most of them said, I don't think AI will ever leave the judiciary system ever again. I think there will be more complex tools in the future. I don't think our workload will diminish. they were very, very straight about that. They thought that their work will not just reduce. It would be the same work or even more work. They would have more complex tools, generative tools. And I mean, there's a case to be made that the imaginary of those institutions is just so taken by the AI world, let's say like that. They don't see themselves not using it. They don't see themselves in a world where AI will not exist anymore. They see it as another tool, just like the internet, that came to stay, and they have to deal with it. They will have to study by themselves to know how to use it, and there's just no other way around it. And just as I'm just going to sprinkle this information here as well, that touches on this, all of those points. There's also a difference between the judges using those tools, which they do receive some kind of instruction on them, and the other employees of the court that don't use it. They don't receive any education on it. And I mean, formally, they're not supposed to use it. The judges told me, I mean, they said no other employee here in my team, they use it. It's just me. I'm the only one that uses it. And if they are supposed to use it, I'll teach them myself. So you sense a little bit of it's something so risky that the judges themselves do not trust the employees to use it. And they themselves are not skilled or, you know, skilled enough to use those tools, you know, in a risk-free way. And they are the ones teaching those employees. And another layer on top of that is the informal use of those tools, because ChatGPT, Gemini, and all those kinds of things are available for the public. So there's nothing stopping those other employees of using those tools for their own work. And the judge would just not know. Mm. And just the cherry on top of that, I know this is a very long answer, sorry. But the cherry on top of that is, just as you mentioned it, about the mistakes, the justice mistakes that can happen and how that affects citizens in a very direct way, in an indirect way. What we observed is that these tools are being implemented in what we call low-risk situations. These tools are being used in very, very, very low-risk situations that there's just no direct implications to citizens. It's not like it's in criminal cases or, you know, family divorces, all these kinds of things. It's not used in that. It's used mainly in very bureaucratic, mostly organization kinds of things. And the decisions that it deals with are much more, you know, institutional. I mean, in regards to the federal court, it deals with cases that deal with the union. I mean, the federal government as a whole and its institutions. And I mean, collective demands, you know, really collective demands. So that's not a super direct effect as it would be in a criminal case if any mistake were to happen. But what we what we defend is because of how this is happening, the adoption of these tools is happening in low-risk situations, in very high-pressure work environments, huge workloads, seen as a miracle tool, licenses for everyone, there's an incentive for it, the judges do not see themselves not using AI in the future, etc., etc., etc. There's just no way around AI. What we see is they might use the results of those AIs in low-risk situations as a means to justifying implementing AI tools in higher-risk situations in the future. So it's just a huge, huge, huge snowball effect of how things are being dealt with and how things will be in the future.
One of the things that this is the kind of final question from me, really, because you give me a lot to think about, is INCJ is an international network of people who look at criminal justice issues. Have you thought, and what you're describing is something which, if you like, normalizes the processes. So if you're asking Amazon to develop systems and processes, well, to make it cost effective, they won't just implement a process for Brazil or for the UK. They'll implement a process which can be applied across territories. Have you thought about, as part of your PhD work, as to how you can compare how this is being implemented in different territories with different systems? And is this something which is there a commonality, a normalization between these things, or is there a pressure to normalize, or is this, because it sounds very familiar what you're talking about, is across every aspect of, you know, all kinds of bureaucratic life, it sounds like this is something which is being thought about in the same way.
Yeah, what we saw during the literature review we did during the masters is that this phenomenon happens all throughout all public institutions adopting AI and digitalizing and modernizing. The digitalization of public institution systems, etc., it follows kind of the same things, really. I was last year at Erasmus doing a symposium on AI imaginaries, etc., and I was the only one speaking about the judiciary system. Everyone was talking about the welfare institutions, organizations, and some other criminal aspects of it as well. Like a colleague of Professor Victoria Knight, David Raho, he is a probation officer and he researches about AI use in probation. So, and we all see the same signs. We all see the same signs. It's happening very, very similarly. And I mean, what you asked me is exactly what I'm going to do. In my PhD, I'm trying to replicate the methodology we did in my master's with judges, international judges. So we can see how similar it is, even though it's very different judicial systems, but how similar the perception of the transformational work has been felt by judges, and how this AI implementation is happening in different countries. I might focus on Dutch judicial system, because over there I have some contacts with the University of Groningen, and they have a partnership that's called the Julia Project, which gives out workshops and trainings and instructions to judges on AI use. So that might be a great gateway to, you know, talking with the judges on their experiences with those tools. And another thing is, one of the things I want to check out doing my PhD is that there's an aspect of regulation that I didn't mention before. But in Brazil, in 2020, the National Council of Justice, which is a higher organization that, you know, it does some regulation on all courts and etc., gives some recommendations, it issued one of those regulations, one of those norms on AI use in 2020, that was before ChatGPT, but it was so broad and so generalistic that judges felt that it really deprived them on the liberty, on flexibility to develop those systems. So everything had to be made a little bit hidden. That's not the right word, but you get the gist of it. But they didn't feel like they could, you know, really, really tackle some advanced technology, and everybody was doing their own thing. But right now, just in the end of 2025, the judges that I interviewed, he was part of this lobby that was happening to redo this regulation to make it a lot more specific and a lot more liberal towards AI use and generative AI, you know, being very, very specific on how to deal with those things and how to develop those things internally. So that was just, you know, issued the end of last year. So the next 5 years, which is, I mean, broadly speaking, the time of my PhD, we'll be observing how this new regulation will change the speed of the adoption of those tools. Because as I mentioned earlier, 2020 to 2025 was a very transitional period for them. In the middle of it, they saw the rise of the AI tools, the implementation, etc. But it was something that, you know, I will not bore you with the details of it, but the federal court has a lot more resources and has a much more diminished workload. So they were able to implement much more complex and more tools, AI tools, in the same period that the state court could only just implement one or two, you know. And because the state court is just huge, they are just, I think it's one of the biggest courts in the world, São Paulo State Court. The amount of cases they deal with is absurd. So they just couldn't divert the way they were dealing with cases to adopt some tools, some other tools that they were not sure if they would work. And the resources were limited. The human resources were limited. The workload was much higher. So there's a really there's a real difference between how both courts in the same country, in the same state, have dealt with the AI adoption, you know. And this is a very stark difference indeed. And the judges from the state court all said that this regulation stopped them from adopting more tools. They felt that the regulation was just too obscure in its details, and they didn't want to risk developing something that would go against the regulation, because they didn't have a lot of resources. So you just couldn't make something that then would be, you know, submitted and the National Council of Justice would deny it. So they had to be a lot more cautious about it. And the new regulation promises that will make it a lot more liberal for them to develop other tools, more complex tools. So the future awaits with a lot more consequences to be seen. And I'm really, really interested in seeing how international judges see the situations as well, see the perceptions on it. Because I know, Rob, you have to. I'm so sorry that I talk too much on it, but it's a really, really interesting subject. I love my research.
Across.
One of the differences when I was talking to people in the European Union about it is that a lot of them said that this situation that happens in Brazil, where each court has its own system has its own IT section, you know, that develops these things for them. And it's a very heterogeneous kind of scenario. Everyone in the European Union said, I mean, this just wouldn't happen. We would have something come, you know, top down for the courts. No, that something would be decided and developed in the higher ups and then come down to the courts in a much more homogenous way. And what this causes is that the Brazilian courts all have very different experiences with these technologies. So that's going to be a fun thing to look out for.
The pressure of centralization actually goes against what the technology can, the affordances of the technology for decentralization, which is my area of interest. I it's fascinating, and I think everybody listening to this is going to wish you the best of luck with your PhD research, because the importance of this, and not to put any weight on your shoulders, if you like, but the importance of this is that we need to understand how this process is going to be implemented and what the risks and the benefits are, and just taking this is how we did it in the past kind of safety first approach is not sufficient for dealing with things in the future. So, and that the international collaboration I think is going to be very important, and so we really do look forward to having more conversations like this in the future and bringing you into roundtable discussions and things to kind of talk about your work. So, and I'm glad that you're so passionate about it. What's the best way for people to contact you? Is LinkedIn, I think, the best port of call?
Yeah, LinkedIn. I do not check LinkedIn that often, really. But you can send me an email. My email, I can write up for you here.
I'll add it into the I think I've got your email, so I'll add that in for you. So
sure.
Check your LinkedIn profile. It's kind of it's the only social media that works that we get any traction on these days. Everything else really? Is just too controversial. Well, X is blue skies does nothing, X does nothing anymore, but LinkedIn seems to be the one for INCJ related activities. So
yeah, all scientific you know, sharing and all those kinds of things, I think LinkedIn is the best space for that.
Yeah, it's a bit dull, but there you go. So anyway, I'm going to go and let you get your lunch, but to just say thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, and we definitely will follow up and come back to you and have another conversation at some point.
And thank you for all the amazing questions. I mean, you were just spot on everything, asking the right questions to stir up the conversation.
Wonderful.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.